Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
Unique New York.
Peck of pickled
New York.
Peppers.
You know you need
Peter Piper picked.
New York.
Red lorry, yellow lorry, red lorry, yellow lorry, red lorry.
She slits the sheets, the sheets. She slits upon the slitted sheets.
She sells on the sheets.
Oh no.
She sells
seashells on the seashore. And the seashells she sells are fresh, I'm sure.
Oh, I didn't know that. Like someone like dumps Gatorade on you, you're like
Why did I start that like a ghost? Who knows? Hello.
It's our second Halloween episode.
Yeah, it's Halloween of January. Hello and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. For you, it has been just a mere 2 weeks since you've heard our voice, but it's been over a month since we last recorded an episode. So let's remind ourselves what we do here on this podcast. Today, we will cover a big main science topic.
Oh, we do that, don't
we?
We
do that.
Yeah.
We will answer a science question.
Lovely.
That sounds fun.
Mm, it is. And we will take a little walk around a miscellaneous topic.
I did that once, so I know this.
My name is Ella, and...
Oh, right, right.
So dumb. Okay. And today's main topic is the hunt for immortality.
Oh, shit, that's so good.
Hell yeah.
Oh.
Hey, spoiler. Did you find it? If you find it, you can tell us.
I did it.
Jellyfish today?
Maybe.
That's so exciting.
I'm wondering, are these cool health habits that our listeners can bring into 2023 to make sure they live forever? Find out.
Yeah, New Year's resolutions.
All you gotta do is eat one pomegranate seed with coconut milk.
That's the secret. From the depths of hell.
There you go. And on that note, my name is Caroline, and this episode's question is gonna be, what is a tree? And what did we have before trees?
Ooh.
Oh, yes.
I didn't even know that was a thing. I didn't know there was a before time.
This is definitely one of those things that I've like heard, but have never like really digested.
Yeah.
And so I'm,
oh. So we're going to delve into it a little bit deeper. Go on, Tom.
Two big curiosities. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
My name is Tom, and today's miscellaneous topic is another topic I can't believe I found this interesting. It is emojis.
Emojis. That is actually such a good one, Tom.
Are we talking about like the history of them and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to talk stats,
history, and why they're so interesting.
This is bringing strong sticker energy.
Right? Yeah. Because emojis came up in stickers, but not like a whole lot. So I'm very excited about this.
We're going to see why they're so different, but why they're so similar.
Excellent. Let's go.
Let's do it.
Today, we are mostly talking about immortality as it relates to humans, because for as long as we have recorded history, we have stories of humans searching for eternal life.
It's very funny to just like start off and be like, yeah, so we're gonna talk about immortality mostly as it pertains to humans. I'm like, this is like the struggle is the human.
It is the struggle, the final struggle against death. This is seriously.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Thursday.
Yeah. This is a little bit of a history topic as much as it is a science one.
Ooh.
We get a bit of both here.
I'm excited.
Because probably the earliest record of man's struggle against death comes from the Epic of Gilgamesh. Are you familiar?
Yeah. Is this the oldest story that we have record of, correct?
It's the earliest surviving notable literature.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so story. It's definitely the oldest epic, and it's also the second oldest religious text. Basically, the Epic of Gilgamesh was discovered in 1849 by the British explorer and archaeologist Austin Henry Layard, and it was found as part of a great library in the city of Nineveh, which is now modern-day Mosul in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And this was the library was established by King Ashurbanipal around 600 BC, and he basically collected every notable literary work he could find throughout Mesopotamia, which is now mostly modern Iraq and Kuwait.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the epic itself dates back even earlier than that, as old as 2100 BC.
Wow. Holy moly. And I read it in high school, which is wild.
Did you actually?
That's so wild. What?
Yeah, we had to read it for our English class. But
wow.
That's...
wow.
So it is still very widely read. It's probably one of the most read works of fiction out there, just because of how old it is.
Howdy.
But to cut a very long story short, part
Thank
of it
you.
Goes...
Our cliff notes.
Yeah, part of it goes something like this. Gilgamesh, king of Uruk, had a best friend called Enkidu. When Enkidu dies, Gilgamesh is suddenly tormented with the idea of his own morality. He becomes obsessed with not dying. He journeys across the land of night and waters of death to find the ancient man Utanapishtim, who was the only human to survive the Great Flood, which was later adapted in the Torah and Old Testament of the Bible to the story of Noah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's cool.
Utanapishtim was granted immortality, and he tells Gilgamesh he will be granted immortality if he can stay awake for 6 days in a row, which seems like such an easy task.
Wow. Wow.
This is also my favorite Mr. Beast video. Yeah. I'll give you immortality if you stay awake for 6 days.
Yeah, yeah. But Gilgamesh fails.
What?
So Utanapishtim then says he can be granted eternal life if he brings back a magical plant that makes you young again. But the plant is eaten by a snake. And this is why people used to believe that snakes shed their skin, because they ate the plant, and it's how they renew themselves.
Cool.
That's really cool. That makes sense. I understand why they thought that. Yeah.
But ultimately, Gilgamesh fails to win eternal life, but he accepts it. So the first recorded story of the search for immortality is not just about facing your mortality, but accepting your mortality.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Fucking lesson all this time. Good grief.
Yeah.
Wow.
And as a result, Gilgamesh, you know, he has gained a kind of immortality by his name being passed on anyway through this kind of lesson, which is interesting.
Makes you think.
It's a very wise lesson, but did humans learn from it?
Wow.
Around 450 BC, the Greek historian Herodotus, which I think is wild that there were historians in 400 BC.
Right?
It was much easier. You just have to remember like 2 weeks ago. No, I'm kidding. Of course.
Well, Herodotus wrote about people called the Macrobians, which were located somewhere around modern-day Somalia or Ethiopia, and they apparently drank from a pool which gave them eternal youth. This is the first mention of the Fountain of Youth.
Oh,
100 years later, Alexander the Great became interested in the Fountain of Youth, and he is said to have searched for it. But he died at the age of 32, so if he found it, it didn't work.
He did not
Allegedly.
Find it.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
Did he? Ooh. Here's my new young adult fiction novel. It's called Alexander Found It, and he's still around. He's a cool teen.
Go on. Yeah.
And he dates a vampire. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, good. Yeah, just waiting for that. Okay. Right. Ancient China has multiple myths and legends surrounding the cure for mortality. Mm. An ancient Chinese text, the Huananzi, compiled around 200 BC, tells the myth of Chang'e. And the story just goes that there were 10 suns in the sky during this period of humanity, and they were scorching the earth because there were too many of them. Too many suns. And then an archer named Hao Yi shot down 9 of the suns, and as a reward, he was granted the elixir of life, which he gave to his wife, Chang'e. She drank
That's
it, and
metal.
Her body became lighter than air and floated up to the moon, where she has lived ever since.
Wow. So it's either... Well, and we call, that's called inflation, baby. It used to be you just had to stay awake for 6 days. you gotta shoot down so many suns.
So Chang'e's name is actually now a popular brand of dietary supplements in China. It's supposed to keep you young and healthy.
I'm not
that fucking
surprised.
Sucks, doesn't it? Jesus Christ.
Ooh, not surprised.
Oh, I'm angry about that. Okay, fun. Good.
Now, around 100 BC, Emperor Wu of the Han Dynasty had a 20-foot bronze plate cast to collect dew from the night air. And he drank this every morning alongside jade that had been crushed into a powder. and hoping that this would bring him eternal life.
That can't be good for you, can
I'm
it?
Sure it wasn't. Well, he died, so.
There you go.
But everyone in this story does, just so, spoilers.
Fair point.
Oh, boy.
But I think it's interesting here because this isn't just like a secret elixir or fountain from like legend, but it's something that he's actively trying to make, you know, an immortality serum.
That's a really good point. That is a distinction. Yeah, it's sort of transferred from the realm of myth to almost, because when you describe it, it sounds like so many stories of like early medicine of like, and to be fair, like some of these early medicine things do work, right? Like, you know, when we talk about the pregnancy tests with like wheat and stuff,
yeah,
like
totally.
That, you know, it feels like in the similar vein of that. But also, Ella, I do love the idea. You said none of these work. I do love the idea of being like, yeah, and this guy in 1500 and it worked. And then the next guy, he came up with this other idea.
What was that?
I'm sorry. Was that?
Like,
no, it's not that important. Not that interesting. This other guy. He drank jade powder.
Yeah, I hate to ruin it for you, but we're not going to find the secret to immortality in this topic. But I do find it interesting.
No, don't say that until the end. You'll find it in the mist, actually.
Yeah. Somewhere along the way, that this hunt stops being mythology and starts to become something like science.
Mm.
And you see many, many stories of like this throughout history, but we're going to skip ahead about 1,000 years now because we'll be here forever otherwise.
Because, yeah. I mean, you know, and I don't know if you're going to talk about this, Ella, because, like, in some ways, science does, like, literally extend lives in some ways. And so, like, it's not, like, the most ridiculous thing to be, like, maybe just, like, doing it a bit more.
Yeah.
But it is interesting.
And we will kind of cover this a little bit as we go on as well.
Exciting.
But for now, we're in the year 1492 with Pope Innocent VIII.
Lovely.
Many medical historians claim that he received the first blood transfusion ever.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So he was reportedly...
How did we figure that out? Oh.
Well, he was reportedly coming to the end of his life. He was very ill. And doctors suggested that he be given a draught of blood from 3 young men to restore his strength and rejuvenation.
Okay.
Oh, that's not what I envisioned at all.
No, we were all picturing, like, you know, like, they tear open a pre-wrapped sanitized pad, they, like, make sure it's all clean, they, like, wrap around, they do a few.
He probably drank it from the stories that I'm reading. Sometimes it says he drank it, like...
Is that a transfusion?
From, like, a goblet. Sometimes it's drinking it directly from the boy's arm.
Now I've... I was gonna say, now I've got, like, the image of Bella drinking the blood in, like,
in the little packet.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, when I eat a sandwich, that's not a sandwich transfusion.
Yes, it
that's
is.
Just eating
it. I'm having a chicken transfusion whilst I eat my chicken sandwich.
I think this doesn't sound that far-fetched for the Catholic Church, but
sure.
Despite that, this story probably isn't actually true. I read it in the Washington Post and the Times, but they were both wrong because I found a paper that showed that the first recorded evidence we have of this is from 400 years later. So, but it isn't the only prolific story about the use of blood to regain youth. Because have you heard of Elizabeth Bathory?
No.
Okay, this is for you true crime nerds out there.
Oh, okay, there we go.
Countess Elizabeth Bathory was a Hungarian noblewoman who lived toward the end of the 1500s. And in 1610, she was accused of the murder of over 600 people, mostly children.
Oh, that's so many people.
Who has all the time in the day?
Oh, no.
She's actually said to be an inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, interesting. Oh. Okay.
Probably because historical accounts often say that she bathed in the blood of her virgin victims to regain her lost youth.
That's an image I kind of have in my head, and it's not pleasant. Wow.
I will say it's also probably not true that she bathed in the blood of her victims.
I was going to say this.
Because the earliest account of that was about 100 years after she died.
The earliest account of bathing in blood was 100 years later?
No, of her bathing in blood.
Oh, like I was going to say.
I did think that too, Caroline. Yep.
But she was probably a murderer, though, still. Although it was probably a bit blown out of proportion. But that's a story for a miscellaneous topic. My last historical account is probably the closest we'll come to science in this historical hunt for mortality. Between 1917 and 1926,
a
French surgeon... Sergei Voronov carried out over 500 transplantations of sheep and goat testicles from young animals into older animals. So he claimed that the transplantation caused the animals to regain their vigor.
I have thoughts.
I'm so excited to not edit a single second out of that pause. From
So wouldn't that just be something to do with like hormones? Or...
So yeah, I think that if you're thinking about it logically like that, then potentially then it could be something like science. But I honestly don't think he knew what he was thinking at all.
It sounds more like that, like, you know, that's where life comes from.
Yeah.
So maybe it's sort of that logic.
I couldn't find his kind of reasoning for it. But I will say that, like, the earliest hormone ever, like, identified and isolated was insulin. And that wasn't until after this period of time.
Yeah.
So we really didn't have this understanding. But in 1920, despite this, in 1920, he carried out the first transplantation of thinly sliced chimpanzee and baboon testicles into the scrotum of a human man.
No! Into a human? Why?
In his 1925 book, Rejuvenation by Grafting, Voronov says that the surgery may cause sex drive to be improved, may improve memory, give one the ability to work longer hours, remove the need for glasses, due to improvement of muscles around the eyes.
I'm sorry.
You'll be like Spider-Man. You'll take your glasses off. You'll be like, whoa, what? Much.
Like, there was a point there where I was like, okay, I can rationalize this.
And then it was, your jokes will be funnier. everyone at work will like you.
Literally, like, there was a point there where I was like, okay, I can see this. Okay, yeah, I can agree with this somewhat. Oh, no, we're gone. That's it now.
Of course, one of the things he said that this did was prolong life. And in the end, he carried out the surgery on over 500 men, including his younger brother. He also did
No. He did this 500 times.
Yeah. And he also did the occasional transplant of monkey ovaries into women.
Only the occasional one, though, so it's not that big of a deal. It's fine, just the occasional
but,
one.
But either way, not good.
No.
So in the 1930s, his experiments were eventually ended after pressure from a very skeptical scientific community, which is becoming a lot more like the scientific community that we know today.
That's good. It's good that that stopped. And we shouldn't necessarily take that for granted, I suppose. The biggest lesson from this story is I need to wait for you to finish a sentence before I pass judgment on what the procedure or thing is. I'm always like, oh, that's... All right. Okay.
Still, he claimed to be a scientist and do science, but besides the obvious, every approach here to achieving a longer, younger life are incorrect. Because if we want to achieve immortality, we first have to understand why we are mortal.
I was hoping we would go down this route.
My heart still sank a little bit. I was like, oh God, why are we?
The existential crisis that I'm going to have this episode, I'm so excited for it. I'm going to unravel completely.
I know.
Great. Yeah.
I remember, like,
I'm glad to do this for you, Caroline.
I remember in high school being really fascinated by this topic, but, you know, having only like read a Wikipedia page or like watched a TED talk about this. So I'm really excited to get to finally like hear this from a researched perspective.
So in particular, I'm going to be focusing on what causes us to no longer function properly. Why do our bones get weaker, our skin get less elastic, our memory goes, our muscles atrophy, our arteries become stiffer, and our hearts need to work harder, our risk of cancer increases. It's all just a bit shit.
It is interesting because there are some mechanics to these things, right? Which is an interesting way to frame this.
It's all largely linked to our cells aging and dying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is now a cell biology topic.
Woo!
Yay!
Woo, my favorite.
All the greatest hits from Ella. We got medical history, we got cell biology.
So we don't really know exactly why cells age and stop working properly. There are many working theories, and many of them overlap as well. It's almost definitely a multifaceted process, aging.
I will say, as a, and I don't know if you're going to say something similar, I feel like, you know, in my youth, I've seen like, you know, like a TED talk or like some Reddit article that was like, it's like this one thing.
Yeah.
And if we solve this one thing, it's like T cells, or I forget what, it's like telomeres or something, right? I know.
Yeah, I've heard people and we say are going to talk like that. About that because it is an important part, but there are lots of theories and they will, and they're all going to tie into each other ultimately. I want to present some of the ideas we have. It's a very big field of research, so we're barely skimming the surface here, but. One group of theories is known as programmed theories. This is the idea that we are simply programmed to eventually age and die.
I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
We left the death switch on in our genome. We just got to turn it off, and then that's
and then you're good to go.
So the leading evolutionary theory is called antagonistic pleiotropy.
Ooh.
Which is a great term for something reasonably understandable. But basically, in evolutionary terms, aging is somewhat of a paradox, right? Because, you know, if you're healthy and staying young for longer, then you're going to produce more offspring.
Yeah.
But antagonistic pleiotropy addresses this issue by saying that the genes that contribute to fertility or other essential components needed to be a fit mate or parent are also linked to long-term deterioration of the body. So you get a kind of trade-off or cost of being able to produce good offspring.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. Like yeah.
A real example of this is that something called the DNA damage response, which it's critical in preventing cancer, but its long-term activation has actually been found to drive inflammation and cell death in later life.
Ooh, interesting. Okay.
So it's this kind of trade-off theory. Another program theory is called immunological theory, and it basically states that the immune system just declines over time naturally, leading to increased vulnerability and infectious disease, and thus aging and death. Why? I don't know.
It does sort of feel like it's passing the buck of responsibility. Yeah, where it's fully. Like, it's just when this thing fails and it's like, well, why does that thing
fail? Exactly. There's a lot of that.
But that said, that feels very intuitive, and I feel like I've heard that before as like an explanation for like why this happens.
Yeah. And another group of theories, which I think is quite intuitive, are called damage or error theories. And they say by existing, we simply accumulate damage over time, which is eventually insurmountable. Mm. So for example, a buildup of mutations in our DNA caused by spontaneous mutations and by environmental factors like what we eat, background radiation, smoking, eventually cause your cells not to function the way they should.
That's the theory I'd sort of heard before of like the longer we live, the more our cells have to reproduce. And therefore, the more they reproduce, the more chances there are of things going wrong. And then all of that like builds up, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
I feel like we're going to get a lot of like beautiful words by the nature of this topic, but like insurmountable damage is just like
this last one, genetic aging, is the theory I find the most interesting, and it's what you were talking about before, Tom, telomeres. But let's kind of get into it. So constantly throughout our lives, our cells are replenishing by copying themselves, not just stem cells, but also like younger versions of cells in different parts of your body. So your blood and skin cells are turning over every few weeks to maintain yourself. Some of your internal organs, like your liver, is replenishing at over months.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And your brain is maybe replenishing very, very slowly over years, but that's contentious. But everything your body is, at one rate or another, slowly turning over. But they can't do this indefinitely.
Interesting.
In 1965, Professor Anthony Leonard Hayflick came up with the concept of the Hayflick limit, which is the idea that a normal human cell can only replicate 40 to 60 times before it will go through programmed cell death.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Fascinating.
So the concept basically led researchers to discover telomeres. Mm. So do you know what they are then, Tom?
Are they like, I got interested in this in high school. Do they like help copy DNA or something? I could be wrong. I have no idea.
I mean, you're not totally off. So your DNA is arranged like as long threads that are very tightly wound. That's your chromosomes. Mm-hmm. Telomeres are the caps at the end of DNA that protect your chromosomes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So they stop it from unraveling and becoming damaged. You can kind of think of it like the plastic tip at the end of a shoelace.
What is the name of the plastic tip at the end of a shoelace?
I used to know.
Me too.
They're telomeres. Telomeres.
True telomere. Yeah.
Perfect.
Aglet. Listeners, you don't have to look it up. I got you.
Aglet. So what scientists have found is that every time a cell replicates, your telomeres get shorter. Eventually, they just get too short to do their job. and DNA will become damaged and cells will go through senescence, which is aging. Mm-hmm. Telomere length is very strongly related with age-related diseases as well. So mm-hmm. the length of your telomeres is actually one factor of your biological age, which is separate from your chronological age. You could be 40 years old in life, but then have a biological age of 60, as it's thought that it's possible environmental factors like diet and lifestyle cause your telomeres to be shorter.
So it's not like rings on a tree. It's more like your fuse left.
It's a fuse. Seeing it like a fuse is quite interesting. I think if you look back at everything I've been talking about, you can kind of see how all these theories could overlap.
Yeah, totally.
And all be happening concurrently. You know, there's nothing to say that your DNA damage and telomere shortening, or DNA damage couldn't lead to telomere shortening, or, you know, it could all be happening. And this is just some of the ideas of what might make us mortal. And it's through understanding these biological processes of aging that many people are now searching for the keys to immortality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the 2009, a Nobel Prize winner in physiology or medicine was Elizabeth H. Blackburn, Carol W. Grider, and Jack W. Sostak. And that was for their discovery
the fountain of youth.
Of how chromosomes are protected by telomeres and the enzyme telomerase. A telomerase is the exciting part here. It is simply the enzyme that builds telomeres.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
When telomerase activity is high, telomere length is better maintained and cell aging is delayed.
Ooh, interesting. Okay.
So you can imagine there's quite a lot of ongoing research to use natural compounds or drugs that could activate telomerase activity.
Yeah.
So your telomeres could be made longer, essentially reversing cell aging.
I don't know if you're instantly going to debunk this or say this is good. Is that... I don't know. It feel like it's so easy to get swept in the like, and then this one drug will do it, and then it makes you, you just have this, and then all your telomeres.
But it's definitely not going to work like that anyway. There's never going to be like a single drug to solve aging.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I don't know.
Let me tell you about this part, and then we can have this discussion because I know what you're thinking, Tom. There is a lot of ongoing research that people are doing to tackle cell aging.
Mm-hmm.
I could barely even skim the surface of this topic. All those theories are using different ways to approach those. There's just one other really interesting one I wanted to mention, and this is the biotech company Atlas Labs. They are reportedly using cell reprogramming. So this is the process we talked about on episode 28. If you want a refresher, but essentially this is where you turn adult cells back into stem cells. So induced pluripotent stem cells. And Atlas are using this to pursue anti-aging. How they're doing that, I don't know because I can't find any information on it. They're surprisingly secretive.
Oh.
That's not suspicious at all.
And it made, and when I read that, when I was looking around, I couldn't find anything other than, ooh, look at this cool thing. I started to think, oh, it's snake oil then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But their leadership team includes four Nobel laureates, including Shinya Yamanaka, who pioneered cell reprogramming.
Boy, howdy.
And Jennifer Doudna, who was one of the people who developed CRISPR gene editing.
CRISPR.
That's pretty revolutionary, you know?
Those are the names. Huh.
They're huge names. And so I was like, wow, this is exciting. These people coming together like this is very interesting.
Yeah.
But then I saw that it's bankrolled by none other than...
No.
Our friend Jeffrey Bezos.
No!
Jeffrey Bezos!
And this is where I'm coming on to your point, Tom, I guess. I think pursuing anti-aging or age-reversing research has incredible potential for treating debilitating age-related disorders.
Yes!
Mm. Uh-huh. Osteoarthritis, dementia, things that make the end of people's life horrible. But there is this kind of fine or blurred line between that and a billionaire's pursuit for immortality.
Yeah.
To go to the moon and live forever.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Somewhere along the way, it starts to become dystopian. You know, this idea of only the rich being able to afford youth and disease-free lives could be like the plot of a YA novel.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
In fact, I'm pretty sure it is the plot of a YA novel already.
It must be.
Mm-hmm. I have to think that people like Shinya Yamanaka and Jennifer Doudna have good intentions.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
They are very well respected and amazing scientists. And I think
and
that
like, listen, if you need to someone to bankroll a medicine that you really do think can,
if you believe in it, totally,
then
it's a such a difficult thing. But what you were trying to say before, Tom. I think I do feel that it's like, mm-hmm. when do you start doing something just because you can do it, you know, or stop doing it? I don't know.
Of course, yeah.
It's where do you draw the line? And I think it's too early in this research to actually say that. We've only been pursuing this very seriously for the last couple of decades, and it's still very slow moving. So, but I didn't want to end on this downer. So we have one last section to go through, because the immortality that human beings have been desperately searching for millennia already exists in nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were about to say in telling stories and recording podcasts.
In the songs of my
people.
Do
a Game of Thrones ending. It's like, it's all about stories.
Yeah. So.
Oh no, this is very fun.
I just have a few examples of some kind of immortality existing in nature. The ones that I thought were the most fun to talk about. So, for example, we've spoken a bit about naked mole rats on the show before.
Yeah.
How old do you think the oldest known naked mole rat is?
Get the fuck out of town,
Ella! Well, this
can
only be for
what
as long as
ask?
We've been keeping naked mole rats. So,
yeah, how long do you think that's been, though?
Like, I don't know, 150 years?
Well, you're a bit ambitious, I think.
Okay. 80 years?
No, yeah, still. I'll just tell you, the oldest known 50? Naked mole rat in captivity is 40, so you're very close,
that's
Tom.
That's still, like, really old for
I was
going to
say,
so small.
It might not sound like much, but you have to consider that a rodent their size only lives for 2 to 5 years normally.
That's a great point. Size is a thing, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly immortality, but we've never recorded a naked mole rat dying from old age.
It's That's fucked. No.
They can get sick. They often die from predation in the wild, but they just don't seem to age for some reason, even if they're incredibly wrinkled already.
Oh, they're so cute.
they just don't show many of the typical signs of mammalian aging, so they can have offspring.
Like not using TikTok.
Yeah.
not getting references. They're still on it. Oh, we'll make them mole rats.
They're... Every new platform, they were on Be Real before anyone knew about it. So they can have offspring their entire lives. Some mammals can do this, but it's pretty rare. They're almost
that's really interesting.
Yeah, they're almost entirely resistant to cancer and diseases and old age diseases like Alzheimer's.
That was the fact that I had in my head already. Yeah, that's so wild.
Their bones will have the same mineral content throughout their entire lives as they age.
Holy
so they don't like get things
moly.
Like osteoarthritis, and their blood vessels stay also incredibly healthy.
Okay, what's wild to me is, you know how like you talked about how like death is like a multi-factored thing, and the fact that they are resilient in multiple factors is wild.
Yeah.
They are death resilient. It just doesn't make sense.
All right, death resilient, opening for insurmountable damage. Sorry, just getting this billing right. Okay.
So Rochelle Buffenstein is the researcher that's had this 40-year-old naked mole rat in her possession. She says that naked mole rats haven't read the textbooks. They don't know how they're meant to behave.
That's so cute. So do they just have this naked mole rat like hanging out at their house?
Well, they have. So naked mole rats live in colonies. So she is a researcher who works on them.
Okay.
So is one of them. The story goes is that she had some anyway, and then she started to notice as it was getting into its 20s or something like that, it just wasn't dying or getting older. And then it kind
That's
of kicked off a whole new field of research.
That's so funny. Oh my
That's
goodness.
Like, that is like something out of like a fantasy novel of like your pet doesn't age, but you do kind of like a thing.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
really oh. interesting.
And I'd be really
Who's
going to
get the naked mole rat after she dies?
Well, we don't. Well, we'll see if it actually ages. It's so that's the thing I found fascinating about this. Because we only realised this 20, 30 years ago, we're now just waiting to see how old we can get naked mole rats to be. And these researchers are still trying to find out the secret to their longevity, but some interesting things have been discovered.
Do we know if the naked mole rat has a name that we can read?
No, it doesn't that I can find.
What?
The Wired article calls him Joe, but I think they named him that.
Joe's a cute enough name for a naked mole rat. So.
He's very, very ugly.
Perfect.
And always has been for 40 years.
So as I mentioned before, cells that divide and replenish in the body normally only do so a certain number of times. But naked mole rats don't have this limit on cell replication that we can see.
Wow.
This is probably one of the contributing factors. They also seem to have very efficient DNA repair systems, which fight the accumulation of those mutations that occur with age.
Wow.
Interesting. Okay.
So all these kind of theories that we're thinking of before, they're just overcoming them. They're just very resistant to cell death. And they're also really resistant to radiation as well.
I can see how those can correlate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we can unravel why they have this very extraordinary resistance to aging, we may be able to harness that raw naked mole rat power.
The answer was naked mole rat testicles.
Yes.
Done.
So close. Oh, God.
But like I said, this is a really new field of research, like relatively new for other, because we didn't realize they could live so long. Do you know any other seemingly immortal animals? I think Caroline does.
The immortal jellyfish is famous one. Yeah.
This is Turritopsis dawny, or the immortal jellyfish. It does get sick and age, but it just refuses to accept its fate and basically reverts back to the polyp stage and just starts again.
Mm-hmm.
So it just Benjamin Buttons itself.
It like sinks down to the bottom of the ocean, does its little jazz, and then it emerges again. They're great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've actually only discovered that the immortal jellyfish was immortal in the last decade or so.
Yeah.
Dr. Lisa Ann Gershwin, a jellyfish researcher based in Tasmania, says it's one of the most amazing discoveries of our time. It basically does this reversing using a process called transdifferentiation, which is where one cell type converts to another cell type.
Interesting.
We think that we have cells in our body that can do this, but this kind of research is super, super new.
Yeah.
So it's being explored for like regenerative medicine purposes right now.
I had no idea it was that recent. I cannot imagine how that could shake a field to be like, hey guys, guess what we found? Immortality.
another really interesting, not immortal animal, very old one, is the Greenland shark. Carbon dating shows us the oldest Greenland shark is somewhere between 270 and 500 years old.
Wow, okay.
We're not sure why again, but it might be they have incredibly, incredibly slow metabolism.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's kind of like one of the things I find interesting in this spectrum is like, you know, when you say a jellyfish is immortal, I don't know, it's like, sure, a jellyfish.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a very, very simple organism, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I remember, again, when I was in high school, people being like, this tree is like hundreds of years old. I wonder what stories it could tell. And I'm like, none. It's a tree.
Which is why
I think the naked mole rat is fascinating to me, because that's like a mammal. And so on this spectrum, I do find that interesting where like things like...
There seems to be a trade-off for simplicity. A lack of consciousness for this kind of immortality. Because Greenland sharks, they move at maximum speeds of 2.9 kilometers an hour. they don't reach sexual maturity until they're a century old. They're just really, really slow. Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, but it's not a trade-off humans would make for longer lives. Yeah.
Wow.
So, and in the same way, we wouldn't make the trade-off to completely reverse our developmental stage like the immortal jellyfish.
If I have to go back to being a teenager again, it's not worth it, you know?
Can you imagine being a teenager, but still also like having to like have adult responsibilities at the same time? That is the nightmare.
Having to go through puberty and pay taxes, I think. No, thank you.
But to wrap this up, I agree with something Buffenstein, the owner of that ancient naked mole rat, said. She said, I sort of like the fact that the animals are winning and we haven't quite got there yet.
Oh, I like that.
I really agree with her, you know. I think maybe the fountain of youth isn't meant for us. Ooh. But as Gilgamesh did 4,000 years ago, we might just need to accept our mortality and live through the impact we leave on Earth instead.
I like that.
Thanks, guys.
That was so good.
Oh, Ella, I've accepted my mortality. Yay. Ella, the one thing I was going to ask is, like, how do you feel, given how much of stuff is recent and how much stuff is, like, still undisclosed and under wraps by Jeff Bezos, How do you feel about this in the future? Like, what do you think?
What do you see coming in the future?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Nothing groundbreaking in scientific terms, probably. But, like, in terms of, like, impact on an individual's life, it's not going to touch us, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. I don't think in our lifetime we'll have anything near any kind of age reversing. You know, Jeff Bezos is too late, ultimately. He's not going to live to see anything like life prolonging, age reversing stuff. It's just not going to happen.
Don't tell him, though. He still needs to bankroll it. We need to let him know. It's like, no, we got it. Just like a few more
Everybody
million.
Everybody needs to just make a little circle around him and be like, yes, Jeffrey, we can make this happen. Jeffrey. It's okay. Keep spending your money on it. Absolutely.
Yeah. What we can do on like a small scale is just like very different on like an actual whole human scale. So
Of course.
Yeah. We're just such complicated little organisms, aren't we?
We really are.
And, you know, I think to your point, there's going to be impacts in like, probably other fields of medicine that are very important.
Right.
Like,
yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, like, we can be happier and healthier as we get older whilst still getting older.
Yeah. And I think that is the most important part of this journey.
Yeah.
It's not getting people to live longer, but making sure they live well into their old age.
I disagree. I think we should live forever. I think everyone should live forever. It's fine. It's good. Cool and good. Jeff Bezos, hire me. I'm up for offer.
Hi, I'm Ketchup.
And I'm Socks.
And I'm Ball Bearings.
And I'm Pigeons.
And I'm Water Towers.
And I'm Cardboard.
Surprise, we're actually humans.
Humans making a podcast about those kinds of topics.
Because those are real episode topics on the podcast, Secretly Incredibly Fascinating. That's a podcast where we take ordinary seeming things like ketchup and socks and cardboard and bring you the little known history and science and stories that make those things secretly incredibly fascinating.
Secretly incredibly fascinating.
The title of the podcast. Hear the back catalog anytime and hear new amazing episodes every Monday at MaximumFun.org.
Let's have a little chat about trees. So, our question today is, well, the actual question is, what existed before trees? This topic came from a TikTok that I saw, and I was like, what the fuck?
Before trees.
Yeah, and you know when you Google something thinking that it's just going to be completely not true, and then it actually is true. That was this TikTok for me.
Yeah.
I feel like before we can talk about what existed before trees, before we can even talk about how old trees are, we need to establish what is a tree.
Is this question like no such thing as a fish kind of thing? You know,
it's a little bit,
nothing really fits. Everything is a tree and nothing is a tree. I am a tree. You are
a
tree.
You could be a tree, Ella. You'd be a great tree.
Thank you. That's actually, no, that's not a nice thing to say. How
trees
dare
are
you?
Tall and majestic.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, fuck you, Ella. Okay, so if you were to define a tree, how would you define a tree?
I feel like, have you ever seen the TV show QI?
Yes.
You know when you say something wrong and the buzzer goes
like
off?
The klaxons.
Klaxon, yeah.
Like that.
And I'm like really now worried about saying anything and then Caroline being like, ha, no, got you.
You fucking,
no. Yeah, Ella, this is like, you know, this reminds me of like some of the questions that I think we were first thinking about when we started the show of the like, what is a mammal? I feel like what is a tree?
Well, because it was what is an animal, wasn't it? Which like sparked all of
this.
There
was an animal, yeah.
I think they reproduce, but asexually. No, that's wrong. No, okay, they long. They're not necessarily tall because some trees aren't tall. They don't have leaves all over them.
Uh-huh.
That's all I've got. I'm sorry.
So like a pine tree wouldn't be a tree.
Oh, fuck.
Okay. I'm going to answer this not worrying about the QI klaxons at all. I see a tree. I think of its good old trunk. It's got roots, baby. It's got stems coming out. It's got leaves. It's a tree. And it goes up, got a stem. This is great. I'm glad we turned the cameras off so I can go into this blindly with full confidence. I look outside, I see a tree, you chop it down, you can turn that bad boy into paper, that's a tree. It's made out of flammable tree wood. It's made out of wood.
Yeah,
and In conclusion, Webster's Dictionary defines a tree as...
All right, I think Tom's just fucking lost it.
See, if you trigger all of the QI alarms at the same time, then that's what happens. That's what I'm going for.
Do you think there even is a definition of a tree?
Yes, and you know what? It depends what you mean. Where is the definition? Webster's...
Are you Googling the definition of a tree?
No, I'm just thinking out loud in my mental mind.
I have written down some definitions of trees. I just really want to hear your thoughts before.
Oh, you just want to see us squirm a bit more?
Yes,
okay, I think.
I absolutely want to see you squirm a little bit. Because it's one of those things, like, for us, there are trees around us all the time, everywhere. They are all over the place, and you see them every day.
I think they have, like, a base bit that are, like, that doesn't have any leaves on it near the bottom. Just, like, a little...
They photosynthesize.
Oh, yeah, make... nice.
Yeah, but so
nice.
Do... Yeah. Yeah, but plants, all plants photosynthesize.
They do.
Yeah, well, give me something, Elle. I'm trying.
Yeah.
Some of them have fruit. Okay, Caroline, just do it, because we're just not going to get anywhere.
Please, God.
Okay, so... Annoyingly, different places define trees in different ways.
Oh, fascinating.
So the Royal Forestry Society says that the easiest definition of a tree is a plant with more or less a permanent shoot system that is supported by a single trunk of wood.
Okay.
Okay. A trunk.
That is
cool.
As simple as it gets.
Yeah, trunk's good.
Trunk is good, yeah.
Although you guys call it a boot, right?
Ha ha, Tom. Absolutely.
You guys call it a boot.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Honestly.
Yeah, on trees as well. A plant supported by a single boot.
A single boot. A bit more of an in-depth definition might be, a tree is a perennial plant with an elongated stem / trunk, usually supporting branches and leaves. In some usages, the definition of a tree may be narrower, including only woody plants, plants that are usable as lumber, or plants above a specified height. Yeah.
Hey, these are things that I said. just less in a drunken haze.
In a sentence, Tom.
So it wasn't a trick question.
So here's the thing. Britannica says that a tree is not an immutable biological category, but rather a human concept based on visual criteria. And that there would be a general definition, again, of a perennial woody plant that develops along a single main trunk with a height of at least 4.5 meters or 15 feet at maturity.
What does perennial mean?
Now I can't find it, so I'm going to Google it real quick.
It's a plant that lives more than 2 years. So instead of plants that die and then come back.
That kind of... Okay, that makes sense.
So, like, you're going to... Not planting a tree and being like, I'm going to have to plant this tree again next year.
Yeah, famously.
You think of a tree as being quite tall. So, like, you wouldn't think of a bush as being a tree.
But I bet there are small trees. Mm.
There are small trees. So things like bonsai trees do count as a tree.
God, plants are weird.
Even though it doesn't meet that 4.5 meter rule or 15 feet rule that a lot of places
you must
have.
Be this tall to be a tree.
Yeah. So basically, I wanted to ruin everybody's day by saying that there's no such thing as a tree. It's not like a biological category. It's just what we think a tree is.
The scientist is lying to you. Don't believe your eyes. That is all lies. No such thing as a tree. No such thing as a fish. Nothing exists.
Yeah, so, but we do have that vague definition of like a woody plant over 4.5 meters, maybe with a root system, maybe using seeds.
They sometimes don't have roots.
We're going to talk about very ancient trees in a second. And this is where that like definition becomes a bit wibbly wobbly.
Right.
Oh boy.
So when we're talking about those first species of tree, the real like defining thing is a plant with a woody stem. When do you guys think these plants first started to evolve? How long ago do you think?
Oh, man. They're older than
humans. Do you know when plants first started appearing? Let's put that out there first.
Stop it.
5,000 years ago when the Earth first appeared.
First you're making me question definitions, now you're making me go back in time. I hate this. This is all my least favorite.
I feel like you two hate this so goddamn much. The concept of plants just not existing is a horrifying
I know you're making a squirm. I am very excited to like learn some of this stuff because I am very curious, but I'm in the phase of questioning.
Wait, I'm going to try and do some science. So I'm going to try and think about this, okay?
Love so, it, yeah.
If we think about the Earth being habitable.
Oh.
Plants
yeah.
are the thing that put oxygen into the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
Are they?
Oh, fuck you, Caroline. No, it would have been... it would have been something like corals, right? Because, like, there are
algae.
Definitely...
Algae, yeah.
Yeah,
fuck.
There are... Yeah, okay. Wow. I was hoping to, like, really... Yeah.
No, but like you're on along the right lines. So,
but then it must have been before. I think it was before, like you know, fish crawled onto land. Although obviously that didn't happen. But you know,
ooh, yeah. Go on.
I think plants are before animals came onto land. I don't know how long ago that was. 4 billion years ago.
My reference point is I can see in my mental image I see a long-necked dinosaur a la The Land Before Time munching on a good old tall tree leaf. So at least dinosaurs.
When we think of like ancient insects, we also think
that's
of
also good.
Trees
yeah.
and stuff, right? Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever thought of an ancient insect. Oh my God.
No, I never have. I don't know why, Caroline,
brain.
You're saying it like that's something we all do.
Oh my God, yeah. No, Joe, you're breaking my brain insects. Now. Oh no, oh no, oh God. When did anything happen? Why are trees... Okay, trees are such my bedrock for like, for things, for objects.
Well, literally when you think of Earth, you think of tree. Like, yeah. Like you think of Earth as being this green planet with lots of blue.
Caroline, how old is the Earth? It's 4.5 billion years old, so my guess is that trees are 4 billion years old.
Holy,
that's fantastic
bold.
Guess.
That's bold. That's I think, wasn't the Earth still hot, I think?
So I love the commitment to that. So plants first started appearing around 500 million years ago.
What?
That's not even a billion.
I will let that settle for a second.
That seems so young. That means the Earth was, like, destitute for, like, billions of years.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally was. It took a really, really long time for water droplets to form and for...
All plants.
Yeah, that's all plants.
Like, because in my mental image, I'm like, well, there's still grass. And it's like, oh, no, actually.
No, but humans are, like, 300,000 years old.
Yeah. I think this is something that a lot of people don't realize is how quickly... Everything has happened in the last 500 million
That's,
years.
It's kind of crazy.
What was it, 500 million you said? Or
500 million, yeah, we think is the first plants. To be really clear, that's not the very first life on Earth. That is just the first plants that appeared.
No,
there
I
was
assume
life
they were
on
like
Earth before.
Right. Single-celled organisms for a very long time, right?
Yeah, totally. So when plants first started emerging...
Caroline,
is around
I just want to say... I just want to say, with a question like, what is a tree? And then we hard cut to us in the primordial ooze being like, where's the tree? Well, how did we get here? We're just trying to answer the tree. We're like, you know, on the magic school bus. We're like in this like molten earth. We're like, what's happening?
I'm so glad. This is what the question topic, this is what I want from you, you know?
I'm glad this is what you wanted.
You want our bewilderment. You want our fear.
Yes.
Oh, God. Please give us something. I want to see
I'll
this first
on.
Tree.
So this is around the same time as first animal life. Plants were able to start evolving when the ozone layer had formed. Earth was like less hostile for things living on the surface, and therefore we got plants. We started getting some animal life as well. Also,
no,
yeah,
that
some
is
animal
true.
Life.
Like as hardy as plants are, the Earth was pretty not good for a while.
The Earth
so
was
I guess that
real
does make
bad.
Sense.
Yeah.
So you know, the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, whatever that happens to be called, are they like pretty much they arose at similar times?
Yeah,
then?
Totally. So before we had like plants and animals. It was, like I said earlier, it was algae, and algae are what helped to form the ozone because they were performing photosynthesis. Before then,
right.
It was too hostile for anything to really exist, apart from really, really small organisms, single-celled organisms. So it took for that ozone layer to form for multicellular organisms to evolve and continued on for animal life and plant life at roughly the same sort of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're getting somewhere.
Yeah, totally.
We're getting somewhere.
That's referred to as the Cambrian period as well, when the ozone layer had formed and animal life and plant life are starting to emerge.
I know the Cambrian explosion of just like a bunch of stuff
that
developing.
Is exactly what I'm describing is the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
So after that, plants with proper vascular systems start evolving around 400 million years ago. Plants that produce seeds evolved around 380 million years ago.
Wow.
And the first trees evolved around 360 million years ago, ish, roughly.
That's so surprising.
Right? Yeah. One of the oldest genuses of tree, it's in the genus Wattiza, W-A-T-T-E-I-Z-A.
Rumpelteaser.
Nailed it. So yeah, and this genus was found in New York, which is really, really cool. And they unearthed a 400-pound fossilized like top of a tree in 2004
Whoa.
In New York. Yeah.
Oh.
A flash flood uncovered this fossil.
Tree fossils.
Yeah. So they found the top of this tree, also known as a crown of a tree, kind of like the top of a palm tree vibe.
Right.
But they didn't find the trunk for a really long time. I think it wasn't until something like 2007 that they unearthed this trunk of the tree. And it was something like 8 meters or between 28 and 30 feet tall, which is huge in terms of fossilized trees. It's really, really big. They couldn't find any root systems. We don't have fossil evidence for this tree.
Rethinking of tree fossils is really interesting, because when you say like, you know, like the head of the tree was found separately, it's like, oh my God, it must have gotten in a fight with another tree and it got decapitated. That's very,
Yeah, this tree also is thought to not have reproduced using seeds, but reproduced using spores. So it was a bit more akin to fungi reproduce.
Okay.
Man.
So yeah.
That is very interesting.
Now that we've established how old trees are and what the first trees might have been, we should chat about what existed before these trees did.
The real question.
We're getting in. And there's two ways that you can interpret this. There's like what living animals existed before trees did, or what possibly took the place of trees before trees were there. Those are like the two separate questions that I'm asking. So like, what living beings were there, and what possibly took the place of trees before trees existed? What had the sort of role of a tree before trees emerged? Mm. Yeah.
I don't know, Caroline. I hate
this. It's okay if you don't know.
I know like ferns are really old.
Ferns right. are really, like really shrubs. Old. Yeah,
if
totally.
You think about the dinosaurs again, land before time, what you think is really big leaves. So ferns, yeah. That was my answer. I said that.
Yeah, I love it. That is a totally correct answer. We did have ferns before we had trees.
Gosh, I'm so smart.
You're so smart. I love it.
Well, I guess would we have had underwater plants?
Not only plants, but there's a really long time between the first plants evolving and the first trees evolving.
Oh, really?
And during that time, some animals were evolving.
Alligators, sharks.
Oh, sharks, yes!
What?
Sharks are older than trees.
Greenland sharks. The Greenland shark that I talked about earlier is like one of those animals that has not changed for hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah.
What?
So the first sharks evolved around 420 million years ago.
That's crazy.
A treeless, shark-filled earth. What a place.
Sounds like a place to be.
What a place to be.
So imagine the postcards from then. Wish you were here.
Wish you were here.
Literally, the way I tried to like envision this question was like, if aliens came to Earth during this period, what were they going to see there? And it would have been sharks and ferns. We've established that. Jellyfish. Also, obviously evolved very, very early on. Again, not exactly the same jellyfish we have now. Jellyfish started evolving around 500 million years ago
Well. Well, they're immortal, so.
They are immortal, yes.
They've been around since the beginning of time, yeah.
Also, little fun fact about jellyfish, because obviously fossilized jellyfish are really, really hard to come by because they don't have any hard stuff to preserve or fossilize.
To fossilize, yeah.
So what actually happened with jellyfish is that they would get washed up onto like beaches and stuff, but the sand there was like really gummy and sticky and was microbe rich. And this like sticky sand kind of preserved an impression of the jellyfish rather than the jellyfish itself. On top of that, there were no scavenging animals or birds to eat the jellyfish.
That's such a good point. Wow.
Which meant that there was like an opportunity for them to be preserved. And now we have these like fossilized jellyfish, which like when Caroline, I read that, I was like, that's so fucking cool.
What you're doing right now, like I'm, you know, in my mind, I'm like rendering a like a Planet Earth special. I'm like picturing like these things happening. And then like, you know, like a bird swoops in and you're the like producer over my back being like, no, edit that out. That actually doesn't happen.
Nope,
I'm sorry.
No,
I'm
birds.
Constantly like editing stuff out of this picture and like putting stuff. I'm like, wait, you want me to put the shark acid into this? That doesn't seem right. And you're like, no, trust me.
Right. I mean, I'm like imagining the kind of tourism board advertising for this kind of visit the Cambrian period, jellyfish filled beaches, shark infested waters, the sun is blisteringly hot and there are no shade anywhere.
Yeah, pretty much.
No goals to steal your trips though.
Hey! Very true.
The final thing that I want to, well, there are a few other bits. There's going to be like sponges, corals, all sorts of stuff. Ferns, obviously, as we mentioned earlier. Another one though is horseshoe crabs.
Wow, yeah.
Which have remained pretty much exactly the same for 445 million years.
Good on them.
Yeah, good on them, right? So we've established what animal life there might have been, what plant life there might have been. But there is something else that I want to talk about. Because before we had forests of trees, there was something that stood in its place.
Okay.
According to Smithsonian Magazine, there were, in fact, giant spires of life
I thought you were about to say giant spiders and my mind just was,
oh my god, fuck no.
Oh god. Wait, giant spires of...
National Geographic says about these giant spires of life that these organisms boasted trunks of up to 24 feet or 8 meters high and were as wide as 3 feet or 1 meter.
What do you mean a spire?
A spire of life?
What do I mean as a spire? Because the thing is, so... the first fossils of this thing that I'm talking about were discovered in 1843. And
wow,
obviously, you might think, that sounds quite a lot like a tree.
Yeah.
And it was initially classified as a conifer, so as a type of tree. The specialists on it at the time believed that the inside of this fossil was not a conifer. It was actually a lot of fungi that were causing this conifer to rot. So that's what they believed, that there was a conifer and it was rotting and there was some fossilized fungi in there. So,
but it wasn't. It was a spire of fungus, is what you're saying.
Don't tell me it was.
It was
don't
a fungal
tell me. That's
spire.
Horrifying. Please don't tell me this. Don't tell me this.
There is a bit of a story here, but yes, it was a fungal spire.
Oh my
spire.
God, this is disgusting.
God. Yeah,
this is the most horrifying landscape you can possibly imagine.
This fucking blows.
Eight meter tall fungal spires. Jellyfish everywhere. You can't go in the water because it's full of sharks.
Everyone go hug a tree. Go hug your local tree and be grateful. People say, like, I was born in the wrong time. No, I think we're pretty pretty good. Oh my god.
Okay, so let me share a little bit about how we got to the point of realizing it was a fungus, because we did not realize this until 2001, that it was a fungus. There was a lot of back and forth.
Also, what a beautiful, horrifying story for discovering that, where you're like,
isn't it
no,
so
clearly
good?
It must have just been, and then to be like, that, you know what that is, Caroline? That's like finding out that like a skeleton of a T-Rex, it was actually just animated bones, actually, is what it was. It's like, no, they were just huge bone monsters.
It's so true.
You're like, oh, this T-Rex's skeleton looks like it's been eaten from the inside out by cockroaches, and then finding it's a T-Rex made up of entirely cockroaches. They're working together.
Wow, it really is the Halloween episode again.
It really is, isn't it? Okay, so the story is that the people that discovered the fossil in 1843, specifically John William Dawson, said that it was a conifer that had rotted. The weird stuff that was going on there inside of it was fungus caused by rot. And this theory stood up pretty firm until the 1870s when his theory was debunked. The scientists around him were like, That is not the inside of a fucking tree, mate. Not a chance.
Mate.
No.
That's a direct quote.
But there were a lot of different theories about what it could have been. There were people saying it was algae, all sorts of stuff.
Mm.
Other people thought it was just a different type of plant, which then led to...
You're like, anything but giant fungi. Please, anything.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, but this led to John William Dawson essentially turning around and denying that he ever considered that it was a tree. Because he was so wrong that he was just like, no, I never said it was a tree. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, man, own up to it.
Right?
It's fine. No one blame you for not thinking it's a giant fungus spire.
No, right? Nobody thought it was a giant fungus.
He makes a press conference. I was trying to protect you from the truth. It's too much. You can't handle the truth. That's why.
So yeah, so for a really long time, people thought it was an algae. It could have been a giant plant. And it makes sense to suggest that it was an algae since that had been evolving for a long time at that point. That had been around on
Caroline,
Earth.
Caroline, can I ask for just real quick, for listeners who aren't super familiar, and I know, but like what's describe an algae. Like, it's just like
oh my goodness,
a group of
now,
like green bacteria-y things, question mark?
They're like,
that photosynthesize?
Yeah, they're little microorganisms. They photosynthesize. Yeah. They come in lots of different colors. They often live like in the sea. It could be the stuff that like grows on the side of a fish tank. If you've seen any videos of that, it often is green. But yeah, they're really, really small organisms.
If you want a definition, just Googled it.
Oh, go on, yeah.
An informal term for a large and diverse group of photosynthetic eukaryotic organisms. So it'll be like a big group of single-celled organisms with a nucleus.
Yeah. So we thought that it might have been a giant algae structure. Basically, it wasn't until 2001 when a paper was released which suggested, based on the morphology of the fossil, that this giant spire was actually a fungus. In 2007, this was backed up by a separate paper that concluded that this spire did not photosynthesize. So it didn't do what a lot of plants do.
Just the word spire is
I know, it's
right?
Really
as ominous as it should be.
Adding a horror element to it. This feels like Lovecraftian.
Yeah.
This like this picture of Earth you've painted like feels really just horrible and Lovecraftian to me. I don't want to know anymore. Oof. I'm actually scared.
I'm gonna wrap it up with, why are we referring to them as spires? Why were they so big? How did this happen? What's going on? And why did it stop? Why did all of these giant fungi just disappear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question.
So obviously, the large size is to help the spores spread further.
Oh, God.
Mm.
I know. Mm. And without any trees to inhibit their growth in any way, nothing was stopping these fungi in this relatively simple ecosystem from spreading.
Oh, and are you saying that trees save the world from fungus spires?
I mean, I freaking love a good mushroom, and I'm sad I didn't get to see the giant fungal spires.
No, Caroline, because you're imagining what we think of as mushrooms, which is these lovely, like, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be like the horrific, weird fungus.
They're going to be a large, brown,
fungi-like,
bubbly
really go
things.
They go hard.
Yeah, but essentially, before we had forests of trees, we had forests of giant mushroom-like fungi.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But with the rise of plants and then shrubs and things like that, they started to outcompete these giant mushrooms.
Thank God. We got plants
and trees.
Bless trees.
And that is what we had before trees.
Oh, thank God. Okay, cool.
We are at the end. We're safe. It's okay. But can you...
I don't feel safe.
I thought I wanted the answer. I if I could jump back to... If I had a time machine, a single-use time machine, I would go back 20 minutes and be like, Tom, you don't want the answer, actually. This wonderful curiosity of not knowing what a tree is, just hold on to that. That's beautiful. That's...
Just hold on to that one.
Ugh. Huh.
I'm so glad you both hated that.
Yeah.
It is really interesting to think about, because like we were saying, like so much of fossils and paleontology feels like it's about the megafauna, right? Like the your dinosaurs. Yeah.
Or just even more charismatic creatures. Like, when you think about, oh, how wonderful it is to learn about the first trees and then the first plants. Yeah. And then
and of course,
necessarily,
you know,
think about what happened before then. Yeah. And for such a long time, too.
You know, are very aware we're putting on our anthropomorphization hat with our horror.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, it is very interesting. And also to think about, like, how plants can, like, outcompete. And again, you know, it's like,
yeah,
these, just like the environment of the fact that, like, there isn't much oxygen as there is nowadays and stuff like that. Like, all these, like, factors that are going on is really, really fun to think about.
I do want to say to the listener and to you two now, if you just go on Google Images and search for Cambrian period fungus spires and click on the first image and you'll see what they imagine these to look like, it is absolutely terrifying. It's very alien. It makes me think
it looks
of,
like, an alien,
like, distant
cactus.
Worlds.
This is the other thing that I was thinking about with this. Like, when I was thinking about, like, oh, what would aliens see if they looked at our planet during that time period?
They'd be like, ah, just like home.
But not even that. Just, like, what would happen if we were looking at exoplanets and we came
across a planet like this? That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And just being, like, kind of horrified, but actually our own planet looked like that at one point.
Yeah, this makes me feel glad that we actually haven't found life on Mars, actually. This is cool because it might look like this. Yeah, we gotta talk about fungi as much as they give you the heebie-jeebies. They really are kind of wild.
They're very fascinating.
I love a fungus so much. Yeah.
Let's find a fungi expert.
We should find a fungi expert.
I know a fungi.
No.
Oh, my God, Tom.
It's not you, Tom.
They can be anywhere, at your office, in your car, and they are wrong.
My mom says that the gray house didn't exist, but she's wrong.
He just does it wrong.
Someone in your life is wrong about something. Something small, something weird, something vitally important. Only one person has the courage to tell them just how wrong they are.
You know what you did was wrong, but your daughter is a liar who eats garbage.
They call me Judge John Hodgman. Listen to me on the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
If someone in your life is doing you wrong, don't just take it. Take it to court. Submit your case at MaximumFun.org/JJHO.
Now, we're talking about emojis, baby.
Woo!
The emoji movie? We're talking about the emoji movie?
I'd rather talk about anything but the... Can we go back to giant fungal spires, please? I don't want to talk about the movie.
That's actually, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie. That's actually mostly what it's about.
Before you start, Tom, I just want to say I'm so excited about this topic because I'm sure that you're going to tell us that emojis, like, are prehistoric and not, or were, like, or, like, carved into hieroglyphs or something. But
oh my God, yeah.
As far as emojis go, like, in the digital era, I've been alive long enough and using technology long enough that I've seen the evolution of emojis through this last, like, 20 years. So that is very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, and what I found the most interesting about the emoji history is that there is some impactful history that has changed about emojis since they started around and speaks to the future of them that is very interesting. So we'll get into that. No, Ella, my joke that I originally wrote was that they were based on the Lascaux cave paintings, of course.
Nice.
But I did delete that. I deleted it. It's not in my script. I'll show you.
I don't believe you.
No, not at all.
I can't wait to, like, halfway through run into that joke again and be like, oh yeah, I didn't delete it. What I want to say is that, like, I know this to some people can seem like a silly topic, but one thing that is for certain is that objectively people use emojis.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Unicode Consortium, 92% of the world's online population use emoji.
Yep.
Wow.
And in 2015, Instagram reported that, quote, in March of this year, nearly half of text on Instagram contained emoji.
Oh my God.
Fine, yeah.
Which is wild.
That's a lot.
And there's a really good quote from Ryan Germick, who leads the Doodle team at Google, that really summarizes, like, how kind of interesting emoji are. He said, quote, it would be fascinating to see how many times in a day somebody processes an icon's meaning. To be literate in modern culture, you're familiar with dozens, hundreds of icons. This thing to eject, this means low batteries, this means I have Wi-Fi. it's not a language that's taught in school, but it's a language you have to know to survive.
Yeah.
There's a continuum of this whole visual way of comprehending the world, and emoji are very much a part of that.
It's so, yeah, that's so interesting. I think mm-hmm. it's so interesting that, like, you know, it crosses language barriers as well.
That's, yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's really, like, universal. As he was saying, just day-to-day use of like iconography,
yeah,
it's crazy to think it is its own language. You could, you know, some, yeah. you know, when yeah. some people do like tweets or, you know, like little meme sentences where they spell like do the whole thing in an emoji, and you're like, yeah, I know yeah, what that yeah. means,
yeah,
and anyone could figure out what it meant, right?
And I, you know, it's kind of funny because he says like, it's funny how many times a day people process an icon's meaning, and it's like, that's the same for like letters. Letters are fucking pictures,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, good point.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I was doing this topic like 5 years ago, I might have spent the whole time being like debating whether or not like emojis are part of language. But I feel like by this point in time, it's stood the test of time. And I think it is more generally accepted that like it is a part of internet communication. And,
yeah, of course. Of course.
So instead, I'm going to spend this topic talking about some of the interesting things about why that is the case and some of the technical aspects. I'm going to start really quick with some fun stats about emojis, because while we don't know how many times people process emojis, like Ryan was curious about, we do have some stats about their usage that I think are super interesting. For example, do you all happen to know what the most used emojis are?
I think it probably changes in different countries. First of all,
I have a few stats on that.
Oh, lovely.
So it's going to be like the crying, laughing. Also, in age ranges, it's going to change as well, right?
Ooh, we don't have those numbers, but that's very interesting.
Yeah, if we don't have that data, it definitely would be different.
One time, somebody in my old Discord server was like, you use emojis like a millennial. And I was just like, what the fuck does that mean? What the fuck does that mean? So yeah, it definitely changes by age range.
And year by year, it probably would change as well, depending yeah. on kind of, because, you know, mm-hmm. different emojis come in at different times. But I reckon like pretty universally, like the crying, laughing face or like, and mm-hmm. a love heart.
Yeah.
Maybe. No?
No, you got literally one in two, Ella. Nice. So according to the Unicode Consortium in 2021, the highest were face with tears of joy, which is
nice.
The technical term for the laughing emoji. The red heart, obviously, because so many medical students use emoji. rolling on the floor laughing, which is basically just like the laughing one tilted to the side.
Mm-hmm.
Thumbs up, which makes perfect sense.
Oh, I'm also surprised that's not higher.
Yeah.
That's a holdover that because I'm so used to like when using the internet, when you just like things and have a thumbs up on Facebook yeah. or something. That's a holdover for me that I still feel the need to put thumbs up to people's,
yeah. Yeah.
even if that's not a normal option there anymore.
And there's definitely been some papers I saw about how like emojis function sort of like as an auxiliary body language, right? Because it is yeah, literally like totally. A thumbs up. It's almost like nodding, right? It's like you wish you could mm-hmm. communicate a nod in this conversation rather than having to type out, hi, this is an email from your friend Ella and I agree.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
After thumbs up, the fifth most popular one is the loudly crying face emoji.
Yeah, okay.
Very uh-huh, useful.
Yeah.
So again, as Ella guessed, what's even more interesting is there are some regional statistics that we have. So in 2015, SwiftKey reported that French speakers use four times as many heart emojis.
Oh, interesting.
Arabic speakers use flowers and plants four times as much as other languages.
Oh.
And Americans apparently use the skull emoji the most, which I'm happy to take that honor. But one of my favorite emoji stats comes from Emojipedia, who we're going to hear from throughout this. They're sort of like de facto emoji historians of the web. And they found that there was a place where the loudly crying face was actually the highest used emoji.
Oh.
And do you know where that was?
No.
No clue.
A place called twitter.com.
Okay. Fine.
Which
okay.
says, all you need to know. Like Ella mentioned, there are also some interesting trends and changes in emoji ranking. Like, for example, the pleading face or the like big cute eyes face emoji jumped from 97th place to 14th in the last 2 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
Before we move on, I wanted to ask, if we go on WhatsApp, can we tell each other what our top most used emojis are?
Ooh. Oh, I like that.
This really says a lot about a person.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boy. This is a real called out. This is really called out.
Uh-huh.
Go on, Tom.
My top one is the sunglasses emoji. The cool guy sunglasses, for fuck's sake.
Of course it is.
I use often when I send my Wordle to friends.
Oh, fuck. No. Honestly, then
it's the rock on emoji, which I use a lot, and I know I do, and I like it. That's my thumbs up, basically.
Then it's the yellow heart, which is my favorite color of heart.
Oh.
Then it's the eyes emoji, which is super useful. I use it all the time.
Yeah.
And then it's the, like, content eyes closed emoji, which I only use sarcastically.
These are my top five, which does make me think I emoji like an old person.
Oh, it's the laughing, crying, it's like the sweating, it's the tears, it's the scared, and then it's the crying, cute eyes one.
Oh, yours is, yeah, I think that's fine.
This checks out. This checks out.
And mine, I think, is very indicative of my...
Oh, no, oh, this checks out also. This is great. So hard.
LSR.
Oh, my goodness. What a good selection.
LSR. I'm glad they're so different. Is there any overlap? There's no overlap between our emojis. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Alice is thumbs down, heart eyes, okay face, the invisible emoji, like I'm not here.
I use this as don't perceive me, like the don't perceive me face.
And then it's
That's so funny. I love the
barf emoji, which is very powerful. This is so interesting. Everyone in the Discord, please share your top five. I'm very curious. This is very funny.
Oh, that'd be so much fun. Yeah. Yes.
But aside from text messages, I think emoji also have a ton of really interesting use in other places. From personal experience, I think emojis are also extremely useful for data visualizations. I think they are kind of underutilized in other like serious and even like scientific applications. I think in like papers and documents, having emojis is sometimes really helpful for like organizational practices. Like, you know, we talked about in the Q&A about having... lists of topics. I actually separate them by like a big row of emojis because it's like a big visual indicator that I can.
Oh, that makes sense.
That's a good idea.
I guess yeah, you forget. I think of emojis so like unilaterally as like emotive, you know, things.
Yeah,
but
emojis. Yeah.
Emojis could be anything. It could be like a red block.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's an emoji still, right?
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
And you know, I think we could talk about that for the whole topic. Use of emoji in language is so interesting. But like I said earlier, I think by the year 2023, most people are on the same page that emojis are more than just a fad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think instead, one of the most interesting things about emojis isn't how they're used, but what they actually are. Like, what makes an emoji? And I promise this isn't going to be a distinction that's like, actually, it's only an emoji if it comes from the emoji region of Japan. Otherwise, it's just sparkling pictures. I think knowing what an emoji is actually helps to explain why it's more than just a fad.
Yeah.
And it can help us know more about the future of the emoji, too. So, firstly, as I'm sure you all know, emoji aren't emoticons, right? Emoticons are using text to make images.
Right, I was going to ask.
Your colon, parentheses, your smiley faces, your XDs, your...
Although sometimes emoticons can make emojis. Like, it's like the code.
Yeah.
And that's how a lot of early platforms used to do that. Like, I believe AIM did something like that. And that's actually an interesting distinction that we're going to get to in a second. Another fun thing is, I'm sure y'all have seen, if you've ever seen the shrug emoticon,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of my personal favorites.
I have that saved as a shortcut on my phone.
Well, it's the first thing I do when I get a new phone.
Yeah.
Yep. And the reason it's so hard is because that smiling face is actually the letter su in Japanese katakana.
Right.
Is where you get that from. Yeah.
Nice.
Wikipedia's definition of an emoticon is, quote, a textual portrayal of a writer's moods or facial expressions in the form of icons.
Yeah.
Which seems a little grandiose, but, you know, put another way, all of these are sort of typographical art, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that using text to make art is actually way older than digital type.
Oh, of course.
The phrase typographical art is actually what one newspaper called it in 1881, when they basically, they use their existing printing press typesets of like parentheses and dashes in weird directions to make faces. I'll show you guys an example. It's really cute.
Oh,
okay. These are so good.
Yeah.
I love astonishment so much.
Well, definitely, these will definitely be in the show notes. But yeah, you know, I think as long as there have been standardized type, there have been people making funny pictures with them.
Yeah.
But again, that's not what an emoji is. Now, some people think emojis are pictures that you send. On some phones, next to the emoji keyboard is like a sticker keyboard or a GIF keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
But emojis aren't really pictures either. You know, nowadays we can send images like lickety-split, but especially in the context of the 1990s when emojis started, that was a big important difference. Because if you were to send a picture of a modern emoji as an image instead of an emoji, it would take up the same amounts of memory as sending 20 pages worth of words from a book.
Wow.
It's a lot of data. And in fact, you know, emojis came about before phones and pagers could even display or send photos. So what is an emoji and how do they get around this problem of sending photos? So the way your computer sends an emoji is just like how it sends a letter of the alphabet.
Oh.
And the way a computer does that is, let's say, you know, I'm watching a streamer and I type the letter F in chat. I'm not sending an image of the letter F. I'm actually not sending the letter F at all. I'm sending what's known as a code point. And it's ones and zeros that my computer and the streamer's computer and everyone else's computer knows to then turn into the letter F.
Okay.
And along with letters, there's code points for like the copyright symbol and, you know, letters in other languages. And there was even one for like a heart symbol. So the idea behind emoji was, what if we could agree that one of the spare code points that we're not using, instead of representing a letter, represented a piece of poop with a smiley face?
Okay.
Yeah. And so if both of our computers agree that that's what that code point number means, then instead of sending a whole picture of poop, I can just send the poop code point and your phone can pull it up from its own memory.
Of course.
Just like it would with like a letter.
But that code point isn't consistent, like with a font. So if you, you know, if you type an F on Facebook and F on Twitter, you'll come out with a different font.
Exactly.
And if you put that emoji in WhatsApp versus Facebook, you get a slightly different version of the emoji, which is like, so it's like an yeah. emoji font. Is that an Arial emoji or is it a Comic Sans emoji? I'm not saying it is exactly yeah. like that. I'm saying
you're saying that emojis come in fonts.
Yes,
right?
exactly.
But they do like represent a thing.
Yeah,
so,
it's always a poop with a smile, but it might be a cheekier poop. It might be a sadder
yeah,
poop.
Yeah. And there's some like funny examples of that where famously Microsoft got ragged because their hamburger emoji was like, it had like cheese on the bottom layer, and then like it was a whole thing. There was an episode of Food Theory, Caroline, where they
I was just gonna say there was an episode where have I heard this before? It was Food Theory. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, have either of you ever seen that symbol when the emoji doesn't load on your phone?
Yeah, it's like a question mark and some other bits.
Sometimes if it'll look like a rectangle with some numbers in it, and those numbers are the code point.
Oh, interesting. Oh. Okay.
Yeah, you're seeing it because your phone doesn't know what this new code point is supposed to be. It's not, they don't know it's supposed to be smiling poop yet until you update it. And there have been things like Wingdings before this, but that required like changing to a new font and like all kinds of workarounds that often broke. There's a really famous Microsoft Outlook bug where smiley faces in emails would turn into the letter J because like Wingdings wouldn't translate. So you would type out colon parentheses, it would turn it into a Wingding smiley. And then when you sent it, it would turn back into just the letter J because people didn't have the font.
If you don't know, I don't think everyone knows this, but Wingding is a typeface, is a font, but it is mostly made up of like icons. It's horrible, disgusting. I don't know why it exists. So is Wingding considered emojis then? Is that a...
Well, I wouldn't say it is because it's... An emoji is giving their own code point, right? They are on the same technical priority as a letter. Not just like a fonted letter, but like the letter A. And therefore, in some ways, they're also given the same social priority as a letter in a sense.
Okay.
It is a distinct difference from Wingdings. I just wanted to bring it up because some people think that. So, in the 1990s, Japanese phone carriers started doing this with their phones, like using these extra code points to make pictographic symbols, and they used the word emoji. And this is one of the wildest facts about emoji. Do you know where the word emoji comes from?
Well, my instinct is like in the same way for emoticon, because it's emotion something.
Mm-hmm.
That's not it at all. So emoji comes from the Japanese word e, which means picture, and moji, which means written character.
Oh, okay. Oh.
It is a complete coincidence
that it sounds like emoticon.
Oh, well, 100% that coincidence. Wow. And what's interesting is that that etymology, like picture character, actually describes what we just learned about how emoji works. Instead of the American etymology of it, like it sounds like emotions or like emoticons, like a picture character is like what the technical definition of an emoji is, which is interesting. Anyway, in the 90s, because screens were extremely basic, these emojis were like 16 pixels by 16 pixels. The person who's often credited as the designer of the first emojis is Shigetaka Kurita. And these emojis are really, they're really fun. I'll send you guys a picture.
Oh, they are super cute.
Aww. Lovely.
What I'm noticing is that there's not a whole lot of faces in there.
Yeah. You can, there's sort of this balance of like functionality.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as like sort of like creativity to them that you know, also the fact that there's this incredible limitation of it being 16 by 16 pixels.
Mm-hmm. I just love that there's things like a little symbol for ATM and CVS and also a sandcastle and a footprint.
Do you see the one below the sandcastle? Do you see what those are?
I don't know what. Is that a little?
It's rock, paper, scissors.
Oh my god, it's rock, paper, scissors. Oh, yes.
Which is so cute. I love, you know, like amidst the functionality of like, you can tell like the first few, it's like sunny, rainy, you know, storming. Yeah. But I love the idea that there's like this built in like fun aspect. They're like, what if people use this to do this? It's very aspirational, which I love.
That's lovely.
And in fact, the MoMA actually has in its collection these original designs for emoji, which is really cool.
Oh, that's really cool.
By the way, when I talked about, you know, sending smiling poop, that wasn't an exaggeration. It's not in this list, but there are some early emoji sets that had poop. Smiling poop. That's been around since the beginning.
Oh, yeah. I knew that.
But with all this creativity, what Japanese phone providers started to run into was the big problem at the heart of this idea, which is standardization, which is, you know, what if my phone says this code point is a heart and your phone company assigned that code point to a smiling poop, right? So as Lawrence Schwartzberg summarized for Fast Company, quote, the telecom carriers hadn't coordinated their code points, which left Japanese users on the constant brink of a social meltdown. Sending a thumbs up, say, could result in a thumbs down on a different carrier's phone. And so, as Western companies like Google and Apple started to implement emojis for their phones in Japan, and then what started to happen is there was some interest, because it was originally designed just for Japanese audiences, and then because it was in the phones, other people found hacks to like use it, and then people wanted to use it, and then as soon as everyone wanted emoji, it was clear there needed to be some kind of consensus. And there finally was in 2010, when emoji was accepted into Unicode, which is a big deal. Do either of you happen to know what Unicode is?
No.
No, but I'm just shocked that it took until like 2010. Like, that feels so recently.
It really is.
For something that I feel like I've had my entire life. I guess I've had it for most of my formative years, but still.
You know, there was definitely like emojis within environments that like weren't standardized. Within your provider, you could be sending these and stuff like that, but standardized emoji is only like 13 years old, which is pretty wild.
Wow, that's crazy.
But this standardization is a really big deal. So Unicode is both the organization and the standard by which text is represented and communicated on computers. Nearly every computing device uses this standard. It's how the code point for the letter A is the same for everyone. And it's also the standard that allows computers to handle not just Latin alphabet, but kanji, Arabic, Hebrew, and over 140,000 characters in other languages. On their site, they also say, quote, Unicode also includes many historic scripts used to write long dead languages. And so in 2007, the idea of adding standardized emoji to Unicode first brought up. You may remember me talking in a previous episode about like committees debating which elements should be added to the periodic table.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is like that, but for emoji, basically. Like, this is their big moment.
That's so good.
As Unicode says themselves, quote, emoji are very different from other Unicode characters. For many years, they were considered out of scope for encoding as characters. But in 2010, after a lot of deliberations and inputs from organizations across the world, 722 emojis joined the list of Unicode characters. And what that meant is that emojis were first class citizens in this technical languages that all modern computers used, just like any other letter in the alphabet, which is wild.
That's wild, yeah.
But, of course, with the benefits of standardization come the negatives and the bureaucracy and the politics and the drama as well.
Surely there is not.
No, all the world, we all agreed that these were the pictures.
No, of course, there's so much debate and discussion and drama.
For example, very recently, in 2022, Unicode announced they would stop adding new flag emojis.
Oh, you know what? I was just thinking, how can we possibly standardize something? Say, if Taiwan has its own flag.
Oh,
how
yeah.
does, like, you know, does China's not going to allow that, right? So it's like, what that has yep. to, of course, with flags, that's going
to
be.
They're very curious to hear your thoughts, but they gave a lot of reasons for this. One is that of all emojis, flags are both the largest category and also the least used category.
Yeah, so, totally.
They also say, quote, flags are very specific in what they mean, and they don't represent concept used multiple times a day or even multiple times a year, which is something that they want for most emojis, is something that, like, people often use, that you can use in combination with other, that you can, like, compose them to, like, mean different things, and flags aren't that. And when it comes to identity flags, they say, quote, identities are fluid and unstoppable, which makes mapping them to a formal, unchanging, universal character set incompatible. Which I...
Wait, so...
I can see...
Identity flags meaning...
Like LGBT flags.
Yeah. Which they have a lot of, but, you know, one thing to keep into consideration, and I'm not saying one way or the other on that, but one thing that is important to consider is the fact that once you've established a code point, it's really hard to remove it. You basically can't remove it. It's like trying to undo a letter. You know, once it's out there, people are using it, and it breaks the standard to revert it. Like, you know, imagine like if everyone's emoji of the thumbs up, they decided to change to a different thing. They're like, every previous text, every previous tweet, every previous document then would render the wrong one. So it's very hard. I'm curious what you guys think about this, because it's obviously, I don't have an answer for what this, and maybe this might change in the future, but it's...
I don't know, because I think we're in a time of, like, a great upheaval and change when it comes to identity, so it might be better for things to settle slightly, if they ever do, before you... what it sounds like, carve it into stone.
they do bring up a really interesting, you know, they have considered, and one of their suggestions is they want to add a lot more color heart emojis, because they notice people will sometimes, you know, if you want to do,
that's a good idea,
trans pride, you do like a pink, a blue, and a white heart to like symbolize that and stuff.
So
like
are
that
the, so the people who do Unicode, like who run it and stuff, are they like very... Do they talk about the kind of social issues around this stuff?
I mean, they did a whole write up on this, which is like how I learned all of this stuff.
Okay,
discussing like this comes from Unicode, these discussions.
Well, at least they're thinking about it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yes, yes, and you know, of course, I don't envy their position to be the arbiters of symbols that have to make sense for the entire world. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
One other thing that people have brought up that comes with standardization is that you lose some of the weirder emojis.
Yeah.
So in 2017, Google finally changed their blob emojis, which some people really missed.
I don't know what that is.
It was like a little yellow blob who would basically do every emoji action, which was very silly.
Oh, I know. Oh, right. Right, right.
Yeah.
I want a little blob.
I will say, I think in this case, I would say that standardization is more important than confusion.
Yeah.
There was a really famous bug where for a while, for some reason, Samsung, their drooling face emoji looked like a startled face.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
So anytime someone would send a message being like, Instead, it would be a very different emotion. and I think those mix-ups aren't worth having.
Mm-hmm. Not ideal.
But also, who knows? Now that we know like what emoji are, who knows what could happen? You know, they're definitely standardized, but there's also still lots of room for different things. But I wanted to end this topic with one last story that I found while researching this, because it is, I think, the most unsung hero of emoji. So I said earlier that the MoMA had Shigetaka Kurito's original emoji designs, right? The piece is called The Original Emoji. And many published articles and peer-reviewed papers refer to him as having created the first emoji.
Oh.
The problem you might be hearing in my tone of voice and how I'm phrasing this information is that he isn't. And Kurito has even said this himself. And there's a really stellar write-up from Emojipedia called Correcting the Record on the First Emoji Set. So it's a really, really interesting write-up. And in it, they explain sort of the paper trail behind a set of emoji that seems to verifiably predate Kurita's. And even though it was released on an originally obscure phone model, that company would then eventually go on to work with Apple to design their first emojis. So it's a much tougher question. And the thing is, we don't know the names of the people who made this earlier set.
Huh.
And we don't know if someone made an earlier set.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Kurita's work is still very important and it's still worth having in the MoMA. The real issue from this is, how did this happen, right? Like, as Emojipedia put it, quote, how did we get it so wrong? How can an entire internet get a fact, like who created emoji, so wrong? And in a way, I think the way the question is phrased answers itself, right? It's the assumption that things in the modern age keep records of themselves, and that record keeping is simple, which is not the case. As Emojipedia put it, quote, people love a simple answer to a complex question, and pointing to one person, Shigetaka Kurita, who created emoji, is simpler than referencing an evolution of obscure phone models with uncredited designers and engineers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what's wild is it's not just obscure Japanese phone carriers who aren't crediting and keeping records. The reason that Emojipedia exists at all is because, quote, they said, the idea came about when Apple added emojis to iOS 6, but failed to mention which ones were new. So when I started this topic, I thought I was going to use Emojipedia to like reference a few things here or there. And in doing this research, one of the biggest lessons for me is that, as silly as it seems, Emojipedia is doing real work that nobody else is in actually trying to record this silly history of emoji that everyone just assumes keeps track of itself, right?
Do you not think this is like the case for like lots of niche internet history forums like that?
Yeah, for sure. One thing I've been watching a lot of recently is Defunct Land on YouTube. I don't know if you guys have ever seen.
Oh my gosh, I loved the then most recent video. So good. Oh yeah. Oh, of course, the thesis of that being the Disney theme and how difficult it was to track back. Oh, it's so good.
I will definitely link it in the show notes. But you know, what they do for people who don't know is they sort of like catalog the history of like theme parks and forgotten media. And I think what both Emojipedia and Defunctland do that amazes me is they like drudge up
these histories that people have basically thrown away, and they show us how interesting they can be.
And so what's great is that this sort of does have a happy ending, because I didn't realize this, but sometimes that work does get recognized. I learned that Emojipedia is actually a voting member of the Unicode Consortium.
Oh, that's so good.
That's so cool.
So their work is taken into consideration and is very weird work.
Yeah. It lends like a real seriousness to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to be clear. I don't want to say that I think like emojis are as important as the printing press, but I will say that they are internet culture, and internet culture is still culture. And when we don't treat it as such, when we don't record the history of it, we stand to lose that history and that culture. So I'm glad that Emojipedia and Unicode and so many linguists and researchers are doing the real work and taking the smiling poop emoji seriously.
I completely agree with you, Tom. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, people will look back on internet culture and see it as seriously as we see people, you know, the printing press that we look back on from 100, 200 years ago from now. you know? So having people keep dedicated records of it will just make that easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. we're having problems, you know, keeping records, even like these questions from like 10, 20, 30 years ago. And like, I just imagine all the anthropologists that would kill for like someone in Pompeii to have like seriously documented something.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
if we document it enough, we can live in a world where the future people don't think that we worship the smiling poop god. That's the
point. Actually, that's honestly, I mean, I know it's a joke, but it's such a good point that like there is a level of ridiculous to emoji, and mm-hmm. if you don't like properly, like, you know, you made me think more seriously about it by talking about Unicode, by talking about how it is like mm-hmm. functionally equivalent yeah. to basically a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we already all agree how we use it in language. So it's like having those gaps filled in mean that, yes, we don't end up with these weird blank spaces where 200 years from now, everyone's like, oh, yeah, they spoke through poop. That's what they did.
Yeah.
You know? What time is it? Review corner time.
Yay! Today's review comes from Clone Direct from Apple Podcasts from Germany. Oh. They say, best podcast out there, period. And then in quotes, they say, the period is meant to be read.
Good. They say,
I just love this podcast so much. The hosts are so funny and have me cracking up whenever I listen, even if that means me cackling away in the bus like a right weirdo. The show is also hugely informative and always entertaining. I especially appreciate the slightly longer runtime as it gives the hosts enough time to really talk about their topic.
Aw, thank you.
We appreciate that too.
Yeah.
And then they say, thank you guys so much.
Aw.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Listening and leaving a review.
And for enjoying
really
the longer runtime.
Yeah, we need to hear that because sometimes we agonize over how long passages get. It's worth it.
You know, we'll keep the emoji in. I thought about cutting it entirely, but because of that, let's keep that in.
Do we have any plugs or shout outs?
I'd like to plug hugging a tree.
We should all go and hug some trees.
And appreciating trees and the things we have.
Go and tell your local fungus to fuck right off.
No, don't do that.
Go browse Emojipedia. It's fun.
Yeah.
Oh, that actually does sound like
there's
fun.
There's tons of history there.
That's a good one.
Caroline, where can you find us? Who are we?
Tom can be found as Tomlin Person everywhere. Ella is Dr. Big Science Energy on TikTok and Ella Hubba on Twitter. And I am Caroline the Bug in all the places that you can find me.
Woohoo!
And you can find all of our things and our Discord and other things and merch and
so much stuff.
Max fun stuff on Let's Learn Pod. Let's Learn Everything Pod.com.
Let's Learn Pod.
Let's Learn Pod. Let's Learn Everything Pod.com.
Woo!
Woo!
Today, we have learnt that humans may not have found the secret to immortality, but animals certainly have. Naked mole rats may have also. We'll wait. We'll find out soon, I assume. We've learned that there is no such thing as a tree, but there is such thing as a towering fungal spire. And we have learned that the universal language of emoji has been globally standardized. And that's a good thing. Please join us next time where we will learn about everything! Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted and produced by Ella Hubba, Tom Lunn and Caroline Roper, with editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lunn.
I saw you lighting stuff on fire on Instagram, Caroline.
Yeah, I've been trained on shows, so I'm doing some fun chemistry experiments for kids now.
Yay!
And
are you going to incorporate that into the podcast somehow? Do some fire demonstrations just
sure,
for us.
Why not?
Yay.
I'll zoom you at some point and I'll just do the Rubens tube for you guys.
That's bonus content.
And it forms a chemical reaction like this. We're all like, what?
Great podcast content.
I can
make a giant glow stick as well now, so that's kind of fun.
That's cool.
Yeah, that got a round of applause when I was last at work, so
if you made a giant glow stick on the record, I would applause.
Yeah, damn fucking right you would, Tom.
Ella, I wouldn't.
How I was about to ask you how your Christmas was, but I think I'd take it back.
MaximumFun.org.
comedy and culture,
artist owned,
audience supported.